Rewriting of a Fairy Tale by Dana Ann Evans. Before there were books, radio, television, or any other means of entertainment, oral stories were the tradition. Storytelling is as old as language itself. Stories were told and retold to successive generations, and the tales would take on new details. Each storyteller would take creative liberty and embellish the story in order to cater to his listening audience. Changes would be made in order to make them more relevant to what was going on in the world around them. Eventually, in an attempt to preserve oral stories, they were put into written form and called fairy tales. Oral folk tales have many variations, so too the written stories have evolved over time. Fairy tales have taken on transformations to keep up with cultural and societal changes. Many times, when oral stories were written down, they were dramatically altered in order to cater to the prospective audience. People have altered the stories, and the stories have altered the people. The themes in most fairy tales presented utopian depictions of life and gave the listener some type of mental escape from their own oppressive circumstances. Carolyn Heilbrun, a highly influential feminist literary scholar, has addressed the question of how the stories circulating in our culture regulate our lives and fashion our identities. Let us agree on this, that we live our lives through texts. These may be read or chanted or experienced electronically or come to us, like the murmurings of our mothers, telling us of what conventions demand. Whatever their form or medium, these stories are what have formed us all. They are what we must use to make our new fictions. Out of old tales, we must make new lives. Heilbrun endorses the notion of appropriating, revising, and revitalizing old tales in order to produce new social discourses that can, in turn, refashion our lives. Times have changed dramatically. We are no longer living under a monarchy like the oppressed people who originated folk and fairy tale. We live in a capitalistic democracy, and our life circumstances are completely different from those when the stories first originated. It is with this modern mindset that we can look at the famous Mother Goose nursery rhyme, "The Woman Who Lived in a Shoe," and imagine a caring mother who is nurturing and loving to her children instead of the stressed-out, abusive one depicted in the familiar nursery rhyme. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe, or at least that is what it looked like from an aerial view. When planes flew over her monstrous estate, it was a point of interest, the pilot would say. If you look to your left, you would see the Duvalier mansion. Rumor has it that James Duvalier was born into money. His father, Peter Duvalier, was a famous American architect. James decided to build a home in order to win the affections of an enchanting young aspiring singer named Madeleine Lefleur. The home was built in the shape of Italy, honoring her paternal grandfather, Jean-Claude Lefleur, the world-renowned architect who, among his notable achievements, was the master architect in charge of the restoration of the Louvre Museum in Paris. For 3 decades, when airplanes flew over the Duvalier estate and they gave their coordinates to the control tower, they quit giving the longitude and latitude and began saying, "I am beginning my descent," over the Duvalier boot. However, over the years, pilots came and went. And many successive generations of pilots, change in ownership of the airport, and change in ethnicity of the air traffic controllers, things got a little lost in translation, so they began calling the mansion a shoe. Madeleine Lefleur had a beautiful voice. She was working at a theater that her grandfather designed. The cathedral ceilings and round seating area was designed like a coliseum, allowing the quality of sound and acoustics to be considered incomparable to any theater in France. When the theater was closed, Madeleine would get up on stage and pretend to be performing in a grand production. One evening when she was cleaning the theater after the night's performance, the director of the production, Manuel Depardieu, went back to the theater to fetch the umbrella that he had left earlier that evening. He walked in the auditorium as Madeleine was singing a most chilling aria he had ever heard. He was completely awestruck at her vocal range and the pure angelic quality of her voice. Chill bumps traversed up and down his whole body and made the hairs on his arms stand on end. When she finished, he clapped enthusiastically, and she, thinking she was alone, ran to the edge of the stage in embarrassment. "I am so sorry to startle you, my dear lady. You have the voice of an angel. Have you ever thought about being in the theater?" Madeline began to blush. "Thank you, sir. That is very kind of you, but I'm afraid you hold me in too high esteem, for I am just an ordinary girl, and I am not a performer. I only work here cleaning the auditorium in order to earn enough money to pay for college. Someday, I hope to be a teacher." Manuel says, "I am sorry I have forgotten my manners. My name is Manuel Depardieu. I am the director of the production that is currently being performed in this theater. And what is your name, might I ask?" "My name is Madeline Lafleur. My grandfather designed this theater." "It is a pleasure to meet you, Miss Lafleur. This is an outstanding theater, and I selected it because this is the only theater that resonates accurately the full beauty of my wife's voice. And I assure you, young lady, that you are anything but an ordinary girl. Your vocal abilities surpass even my wife. Perhaps you have heard of her, Madame Catherine Depardieu." "Oh, my goodness, of course I have heard of her. She is only the finest, most gifted singer in all of Europe," Madeline exclaimed. "You are too kind in saying that my voice surpasses her. It could never be so. Miss Lafleur, would you be interested in being an understudy for my wife? It doesn't pay much, but I'm sure it pays more than what you make cleaning this theater. In the unlikely event that she should ever be taken ill, I need someone who could fill her shoes, and until this day I was in quite a dilemma, as I was certain that I should never find another voice that could equal my wife's abilities." Madeline could not believe her ears. "Oh, my goodness, are you kidding me? Of course I would. Ever since I was a small child, I have always dreamed of singing on stage." "Well, then, I hope to see you at rehearsal tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Madeline started working in the theater. Everyone was amazed at her beautiful voice. She had never had any training, and yet she was without question a rare vocal talent. She learned all of her parts dutifully and occasionally got to sing small parts in the chorus. One day, her big break came. Catherine Depardieu had sustained a broken leg when she was fox hunting with her English friends. The horse apparently stumbled when she jumped over a log and lost his footing when he landed on a rock. Catherine had a terrible fall and suffered a compound fracture to her right femur. Madeline felt sorry for her dear friend Catherine, but was excited about the chance to sing the lead. She felt a little guilty for being happy for her opportunity because it was afforded to her due to Catherine's injury. The curtain opened that night, and the audience was unaware that Madeline was filling in for Catherine. She knew the parts well. When she appeared on stage, everyone was upset that they were not going to see the infamous Catherine Depardieu that they had come to see. Some people actually got up to leave, and then Madeline began to sing. Everyone quickly returned to their seats, and the whole audience was mesmerized by her ethereal voice. The performance was breathtaking. She received so much adulation and praise, and the critics raved incessantly. Madeline Lafleur became a household name overnight. One of the people that were most impressed with her was James Duvalier, a handsome, rich Frenchman who was a notorious playboy. He decided that Madeline was going to be his, and that very evening decided to pursue her affections. He raced through the throng of people to catch her backstage. "Hello, Miss Lafleur. My name is James Duvalier. Let me be the first to congratulate you on an outstanding performance. I was wondering if you would care to accompany me to my sister's birthday party tomorrow at noon. I would so very much like to surprise her with the gift of your matchless voice singing Happy Birthday to her. I assure you, money is no object for me, and I will pay you handsomely." "Oh, thank you, Mr. Duvalier. I am utterly flattered, but I..." "Please call me James." "Thank you, James. I would be most happy to come to your sister's party tomorrow, but could not possibly accept any money for it. Your sister's birth is too blessed a celebration to be tainted by an ulterior motive on my part to fatten my coin purse. Please, I insist, I would be more than happy to accompany you, but only as a friend, not a hired musician." He was totally smitten by her gracious charms. He kissed her hand and agreed to call on her at 11 o'clock the next day.
The people at the birthday party were completely and utterly impressed. The day set her relationship with James in motion. Over the next few months, he pursued her relentlessly. She performed nightly and in 6 short weeks was being referred to as the best female vocalist in all of France. James courted her fast and furiously. He made every effort to impress Madeline. He wined and dined her and showed her a pampered way of life that she had never known. After only 2 months of courtship, he asked her to marry him. Madeline was overjoyed, for she had come to love him, and the only thing she wanted more than being a singer was being a mother. So when he asked her to move to America, where his business was located, she was willing to give up her singing career so that she could have the family she always dreamed of having. Therefore, it was with much joy and enthusiasm she agreed to marry James. Everyone who was of any importance was invited. The ceremony and reception following was one of the most decadent celebrations that would rival even a queen's wedding. The next morning, they sailed with all of her belongings to America. Their ship landed in New York Harbor. Another boat was there, ready to transport them to their new home on Long Island. When the boat pulled to shore and began to dock, Madeline was astonished at the breathtaking shoreline and picturesque countryside beyond it. She exclaimed, "I don't think I have ever seen anything so beautiful. Look at that magnificent and stately mansion on the hill." James replied, "That, my dear Madeline, is your new home. I had it built for you in honor of your grandfather. The perimeter of the home is in the shape of Italy in hopes that it will somehow make you feel more at home here in America with me." Madeline was beside herself with emotion. She embraced him tightly, and weeping joyfully, she kissed him tenderly. Madeline could not believe that all this was for her. It seemed like a dream she was afraid she would wake up from any moment. The house was filled with everything she could ever want or need. Everything she had was the finest money could buy. She loved James now more than ever. James' father, Peter, was ailing and came to live with them just 2 weeks after their arrival. He was still mobile, but becoming forgetful. He was a delightful conversationalist, and he and Madeline got along splendidly. She was glad to have him around because James was away on business much of the time. One morning, when breakfast was being served, Madeline excused herself from the table and ran into the bathroom. James went after her and asked her if she was okay. She looked at him lovingly and said, "I am more than okay. I am ecstatically happy. I went to see Dr. Bridgers yesterday because I had been feeling faint. When I asked him if I was going to be okay, he said, 'Nothing that 7 more months won't cure.' James, my love, we are expecting twins." They were both euphorically happy. They held each other closely and waltzed around the room, smiling and twirling each other as if they were dancing, though there was no music playing. The twins were born a week before they were due to arrive. They named the boy James Jr. and the girl Catherine. The twins were only 5 months old when she conceived again. This time, she had a boy named Robert. When Robert was only 8 months old, she conceived again and gave birth to Teresa. The next year, she gave birth to Matthew, and the year after that, she gave birth to Philip. When Philip was 18 months old, Madeline conceived again and gave birth to Samuel. They filled the home with joy and laughter. Madeline felt so blessed that her greatest desire to be a mother had now come true. She tutored her children in reading, writing, math, and music. They were all well-behaved and extremely gifted. Madeline only wished that James were home more often. His work kept him away most of the time. She felt as though the children were missing out in their relationship with their father. Madeline was thankful that the children had their grandfather Peter around as a positive male role model. Peter loved his grandchildren dearly and interacted with them daily. He played with them, read to them, and taught them how to hunt and fish. He always made up stories about the flying crafts the Wrights used to defy the laws of gravity. He taught them how to be manly men, but he also taught the young boys how to be a gentleman to a lady. If it were not for Peter, there would not be a man around the house. Their father, James, was an absent parent. James had only seen their youngest child, Samuel, one time when he was 3 weeks old before he was called away on business. Little did they know that would be the last time the children would see their father in the home. She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. Her husband had left her for wife number two. Madeline went to get the morning mail. She saw a letter from her husband, which she opened immediately. James no longer wanted to be married to her. He had fallen in love with another woman and wanted a divorce as quickly as possible because he wanted to remarry. He said that he made financial arrangements for the mortgage to be paid every month until the divorce was over and would be sending her $400 a month for any additional expenses. Madeline fell to her knees and wept bitterly. Her body felt as though it were going into shock. She read the words repeatedly. "I'm sorry, my dear Madeline. I no longer wish to be married to you because I have fallen in love with someone else." Her body started to shake, and cold sweat began streaming from her face and underarms. Her sobs turned into wailing, and she knelt there rocking back and forth, clutching the letter. James had never been a hands-on parent, but at least the children saw him occasionally. But now, they would see him even less. Peter saw her crying beside the front walkway and came out to find out what was wrong. She showed him the letter. He held her closely and reassured her that everything would be all right. Peter helped her into the house. Madeline went to her room, closed the door, and cried herself to sleep. Peter called his attorney. The attorney explained to him that when he had appointed James head of the company, that James had taken full advantage of the power of attorney Peter had granted him when he started to become ill. James had taken complete control of all business dealings, and his lawyer informed him that he had made some bad business investments, and now the company was facing bankruptcy. Madeline went to the mailbox every day, waiting for the $400 from James. 5 weeks went by, and still nothing arrived. She began to get worried because their food supply was running low and the children needed some clothing and shoes. Winter would soon be here, and the older children didn't have any hand-me-downs and would need some new things. It became very clear to Madeline that she would not be able to depend on James for financial support. She gave them some broth without any bread. She hugged them, kissed them, and tucked them in bed. It killed Madeline that she had to send her children to bed with nothing to eat. She decided that would never happen again. She went to the neighbors early the next morning to get some eggs and flour. She promised to pay for them that afternoon when she returned from the city. Madeline made pancake batter and put it in the refrigerator. She left a note for Peter by the cupboard where he would go to get his tea every morning before the children awoke. "I've gone to the city today to look for a job. There is pancake batter in the refrigerator for breakfast, and there are plenty of eggs left over in case they get hungry again before I return. I will be back as soon as I can." The first place that Madeline went was to the jeweler's. She sold her diamond wedding band, a diamond bracelet, emerald brooch, and the sapphire necklace that James had given her for their fifth anniversary. She was somewhat disheartened that they only paid her a fraction of what it was worth. Nevertheless, she could make that $900 last for 2 months if she was careful. After she left the jeweler's, she went to the Majestic Theater to look for work. The only opening they had was a night shift cleaning position. Madeline accepted it. By working nights, Madeline figured that she could school her kids during the day and go to work after the children had gone to bed. The older children can look after the younger ones, and Peter was there. Thank God for Peter, Madeline thought to herself. She wondered how James could be so unlike his father. Madeline worked tirelessly the job of two parents. She had always been pretty much mother and father anyway, so all she had to assimilate was working outside the home on top of her daily responsibilities. Madeline loved her job. It reminded her of her singing days. It had been 15 years since that last production. Her early aspiration of being a teacher was fulfilled in being able to tutor her children when they were young. She knew she had built a strong academic, moral, and ethical foundation into them. She had brought them up in the way they should go, so she knew that when they were old, they would not depart from it. Madeline decided it was in the children's best interest to put them in public school. The older kids could watch the younger kids. Peter was getting forgetful. Peter fell ill. He came down with bronchitis. When it did not go away, the doctors told him he had coal miner's disease and had 6 months to live. James did not go to see his father after he became bedridden, nor did he correspond with him by mail or by phone. There were many unresolved issues Peter would have liked to have worked out with his son before he died. Peter always kept short accounts with his maker. He wanted to get his financial house in order as well, so he revised his will. James and Madeline met at the lawyer's 3 days after Peter's funeral for the reading of the will. The lawyer began to read, "To my daughter-in-law Madeline, who took care of me in my old age and was a friend and daughter to me, I bequeath all my shares of the airline industry, and I relinquish my duties of chairperson to her, rightfully so as being the highest shareholder of 63%. To my son James, I leave $400 a month to be paid in full upon successful completion of the monthly cleaning duties of the Duvalier Airport."